Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is September 18th, 2006. Today's Elder Hostel session is entitled Personal, Regional, and Global Perspectives, a Health and Wellness Class, presented by Cliff Hall. Let's listen in.
After my medical school at Columbia University in New York, I was at University of California, San Francisco for internship and residency, and then I spent 3 years at the National Institutes of Health doing cardiology and pulmonary disease, and practiced pulmonary critical care, intensivist kind of medicine at Corvallis for 29 years before I retired 5 years ago, thinking I'd retire to a farm in Kings Valley, which is in the suburbs of Corvallis, to establish a wildlife refuge, which is a passion I have. I was retired for exactly 4 months and went back to work at the hospital as the director of the hospitalist program. That's where a group of internists work full-time in the hospital and take care of hospitalized patients. And I've been doing that for the past 4.5 years. I've had a lot of experience with taking care of people who have serious illnesses, who are in the process of dying, who have had life support of various kinds, so I do bring that kind of expertise here. I don't pretend for a minute to have the answers to most of the important questions that we'll be dealing with, but I hope that the collective knowledge and wisdom that's been achieved here, I mean, we have hundreds of years of experience that we can draw on, and we've all had a lot of personal experience. I can't think of a better place in Holden Village to have the kind of discussions that we're going to be able to have, where we try to bring together the two cultures, the science and the artistic, and bring that together in a meaningful way. And I think medicine and the discussion of some of the issues we'll be discussing today have an opportunity to really bridge that gap, because I think medicine in encompasses both the art and the science. And we'll be able to draw on the expertise that we have here. Before we start, I just want to give thanks to the Elder Hostel people and the Holden Village for sponsoring this, to Marion for getting it organized, to Paul, Carol, and Tom for their hard work in helping to bring this this program off. And I want to give thanks at the beginning to my patients who have taught me so much over the years, to prior Elder Hostel groups. This is either the sixth or the seventh group that I've been involved in here at Holden, and they've all been just wonderful groups and have taught me an awful lot. And I'd like to also thank my mentor, who's not here, but who introduced me to Holden Village, Dave Cleaver. That's a retired oncologist who is currently dying of congestive heart failure back in Corvallis. And I'll tell you a little more about him as we go along through the program. And I want to thank Gay, who's been my loyal partner here and keeping me on the straight and narrow most of the time. But I hope we have fun. There's some basic ground rules. Number one, we will have a 5-minute break at 9:15, because it's 1.5 hours is a long session for any of us. So we'll have a brief break at 9:15, and if I'm blithering away at 9:15, just somebody, Gay, will stop me, and we will have that break. This is not a lecture. It's not a didactic sessions. You're really going to be sharing. It's going to be interactive, and I expect people to speak out and to offer their opinions and thoughts and experiences. I think we should be respectful of each other, and I'm sure we're going to have differences of opinion on some of the issues as we go through the course of the week, and I think we need to be respectful of other people's opinions. Some of us have gray hair and have been around, and some of us, our hearing may not be as good as others, so speak loudly and clearly when we do make comments, and if you don't hear or don't understand, yell and scream. And what I would like to have everyone do when they're going to make a comment, to introduce themselves, just say, I'm Cliff from Corvallis, or I'm Ben from Seattle, or whatever it is, so that we continually have the chance to say, yes, that's who it is, so we keep the names close in our minds. Reading material, I have brought in several several books. And Gabe, could you pass the reading list a little bit? These are books that have been useful to me, and so I have them listed on a sheet that really cover much of what the five sessions here will be covering. And I've just stated a couple of sentences about each of the books. If you're going to get just one book and read it about medicine and about end of life, I would recommend this book. Has anybody read this book? Yeah. This is How We Die by Sherwin Nuland. Sherwin Nuland was a general thoracic surgeon at Yale University Medical School in New Haven. And this is really his odyssey of and his growth as a surgeon, as a human being, dealing with very sick people over the years, and how he has looked at death and dying. And he has written what I think is just a really beautiful book. Other books, Governor Lamb, ex-governor of Colorado, has written a book called The Brave New World of Healthcare. And I think for today's kind of topics we'll be talking about, he has really summarized very well. He's somewhat repetitious the way he's not a writer, he's a politician, so he tends to hammer away at issues. But I think it's a very good book, not necessarily the best written book, but a very good book about the key issues facing the American healthcare system right now. When it comes to aging, and we'll be talking about that, Jimmy Carter wrote a very nice little short book called The Virtues of Aging. A lot of wisdom from our president. There is a nun study, and we'll be talking about this later on. I don't know how many of you are familiar with the nun study that examined a large group of nuns and followed them for a number of years, looking at what it was about some of these women that allowed them to age so well, so successfully, whereas others didn't. This was a relatively controlled group of people. And this is a great, great book if you're interested in aging gracefully and aging and some of the habits of very healthy people. For more intellectual or a much, much more detailed book about the ethics of death and dying, this book by Margaret Batten, who is a professor of philosophy at the University of Utah, is a great compilation of essays, and I would recommend it if you're interested. It's a little heavier reading, but it's a great book. And finally, just a great handbook about aging is this Aging in Stride, and I would certainly draw your attention to that. It's sort of a handbook of what you can do, and it's written by a clergyman who actually lives in Corvallis, Oregon, by a physician and by a geriatrician and a lawyer, and it has pretty much everything a how-to book, how to do it book of getting older and how to take care of yourself and take care of your elder friends and family members. So it's a very, very useful book. We'll also have a few handouts from time to time in the session. My goals here are to raise some questions, not necessarily to provide answers, but to raise questions about important issues that are facing medicine with respect to health and wellness as we go into this next century. And some of the questions that we'll raise will be troubling. Some will be controversial, and some will be emotional. And so that's to be expected, and don't be surprised. I will try to facilitate the discussions. We will challenge each other's preconceived notions and things that we accept, many of us accept as facts, which may not be. And so we may find some interesting things as we go along. And we'll search for solutions for some of these issues. Recurring themes that will occur again and again, I think, in our discussions will be the difference between health and health care. That's really an important distinction, and this will come up again and again. Health is a goal to help us achieve other goals that are more important. Health care is not a goal in itself. So the goal to have more health care is not in itself a goal if it does not achieve better health, and better health in turn help us achieve a more full and productive and satisfying life. And I think we frequently get into this discussion, we've got to have more money for more health care, and that may not really be in the interest of health. And we'll get into that discussion as we can find out that for every dollar that's spent on health care, it means that we have a dollar less to spend on something else. And it may be that there are other things that promote health more than health care.
Studying geology.
That's pretty doubtful, but it may be. We'll talk a lot about, as we go into the thing, about aging gracefully, about accepting limits, not only our personal limits, but accepting limits as far as what society can do and can't do. And we'll face some ethical challenges, and probably the biggest ethical challenge is how we deal with essentially unlimited demand in a situation of limited resources. We don't have unlimited resources, and yet the demand for services may be essentially unlimited. And in most ethical discussions and decisions and controversies, it's not between good and evil. I mean, that's easy. That's easy. It's really when there are two goods and they're competing goods that make for the greatest challenges that we have. For instance, if I have a patient who has a disease that might be communicable, one good is that this person expects confidentiality in discussing it with me. On the other hand, if I know this disease is communicable and can be spread to someone else, to his partner or to whoever, what's my obligation there to disclose this information? So here we have two goods and they compete. And that's where the ethical challenges come as we deal with issues in this world. They're not between this is a bad person, this is a good person, or this is obviously bad and this is obviously good. Those questions and conflicts are really pretty easy. We're going to be doing five sessions. The first one is talking about health and health care and from a personal and a national and a global perspective. Tomorrow we'll talk and have a discussion about aging gracefully, and aging and wellness. On Wednesday, we'll talk about spirituality and medicine, how those two interact and affect each other. We'll talk about, in the last two sessions, some of the ethical issues that we're facing that as a society, the challenges that we have, especially as it deals with end-of-life issues. And as a society, I think the Terry Schiavo case last year has demonstrated that we don't have unanimity in this society whatsoever about what is the right way to face the end-of-life issues. And maybe we can come to some resolution here. If there are other topics and things that people want to talk about, this is really open. This is your elder hostel. This is not my elder hostel. It's unlike geology, where none of us know anything else about geology, and we really have an expert who will teach us. Here, we really will be teaching each other, because we all have experiences, and no person's opinion here or belief system is necessarily right, and someone else's is wrong. So we have this is a different thing, whereas when Don tells us that this is a piece of quartz or a piece of whatever it is, and I say, no, it's feldspar, I don't even know what those things are, and I've been to three of his courses, then he's right and I'm wrong. Simple. So we can look into health and health care, and we toss those terms around a lot. Does anybody want to tell me what they think health is? Yeah.
I like the school of thought that regards it as the absence of dis-ease, not with a reference point, not chronicity, I mean, not cancer or heart, but the idea in a body that is at ease and is not diseased. Psychologically, I think it would be the absence of probably a neurotic kind of anxiety. Physically, the body would be toned and fit and fed properly. And certainly spiritually, I would suggest, since we're designed to soar, that there would be that component too. So, and if not, then I would see it would be a diseased body, but health to me would be the absence of that, of the disease.
So it would involve not just physical health, but would involve emotional and spiritual health as well. Any other comments about? Yes.
I think most of
us. Let's identify yourself and where you're from. Yeah.
I think the way you said to busy identifying was, my name is Cliff and I'm from where?
Yeah. Hi, Cliff.
Or Rick.
Yeah. My name is Rick and I'm from Minnesota. Most of the time, I think we think of health as absence of sickness.
And I think that's I think most of us would say that's right, that we don't want to be ill. But we just had another comment that involved a wider view about what health is. Yes.
I didn't hear that one.
I'm sorry?
I did not hear that.
He didn't hear it either.
No. Kind of put it down into a few words.
Let me just talk about the way the CDC defines it, which is very similar there. It's a state of complete physical, mental, and social well-being, not merely the absence of disease or infirmity. That's the way that's the way your U.S. government defines health. The World Health Association.
Could you repeat that?
I would be happy to. A state of complete physical, mental, and social well-being, and not merely the absence of disease or infirmity. That makes a distinction between disease and infirmity too, because you might lose a leg, and you might have an infirmity because of that and a limitation, but you don't. It's not a disease.
So, does that well-being depend on the person? Whether you're in health depends on whether you feel I'm being well.
That's a very interesting thing. If you think you're healthy, are you healthy? Are we all walking around, or do you want to be like what the medical profession has done, which is to define illness as so wide that virtually everybody is ill? I mean, we have medicalized the society so that we have people who feel perfectly healthy, but their blood pressure may be a little bit too high, or their cholesterol is a little bit too high, and therefore they have a disease. And so they have to go and buy a pill. And this all feeds into the whole healthcare industry as to whether someone is ill or sick. I think that's a good point.
So the government definition that you just read us excludes what you defined as a spiritual component. So they go physical and mental.
And social. Now, the World Health Organization defines it a little more widely here, and they say that it's a dynamic state of complete physical, mental, spiritual, and social well-being, and not merely the absence of disease or infirmity. So the World Health Organization has included spiritual as well as the physical, mental, and social well-being.
Do you know when that definition was promulgated?
January 1998.
And what did they use before that?
They didn't have spiritual. They used I don't have what they used specifically at that time. The chiropractors defined it as the absence of disease, the status of optimum function of the nervous system. I'm kind of focusing right in on it.
Hi, Neil. What motivated then the World Health Organization to include spiritual? What was the dynamic there that motivated that?
I have no idea. I would imagine it was some view or some pressure from somewhere that felt that there was more to human health than just physical. And emotional. I imagine it probably, I think almost all these definitions started out as absence of disease. And then they started adding more to it. So it was more than absence of disease, mm-hmm. as to, yeah, to promote health. Don.
I'm Don from Portland. It just came, what are the names of the two organizations that came up with those two definitions? One is the Center for Disease Control, and the other is the World Health Organization. One has to do with controlling disease, and the other has to do with health. I don't know if that has anything to do with it or whether it's coincidence.
Interesting.
Good point. Shirley has a question.
Oh, I was just going to say, I'm Shirley from Portland. I was just going to say there a lot of people, if they feel like they can meet their goals every day and do what they want to do, that they are healthy. You can say everyone has something wrong with them, but if you can function and do what you want to do, then you would feel healthy.
Good point.
I think that's a good point. Jimmy Carter deals with, in a paragraph, talks about what is good health, and I'll just quote what he has to say. He's obviously a senior citizen and someone that's had a lot of time to think about things. It's not just the absence of a physical illness or something like a long vacation without pain. I would say that good health, more than being able-bodied, involves self-regard, control over our own affairs, strong ties with other people, and a purpose in life. These things don't just evolve automatically, but have to be sought and maintained. I think he really says that very, very well. And I think what we're saying in general terms, we talk about emotional, spiritual, all those things, Jimmy Carter puts it right there. I think that's probably what we're all trying to achieve when we say what we want to achieve is good health. And there are, having said that, trying to measure it is something very, very different. So we have a general sense. Here's where we go from the art or the aesthetics of what good health are into the practicalities of what really is good health. Is it how long you live? Is it how well you live? Is it how functional you are, is what your IQ is when you're 80 versus when you're 30 or whatever. So it's hard to do that, but there are measurements that we can get kind of a handle a little bit on some health things. And certainly that's the way the World Health Organization, the CDC, and other or U.S. Public Health Service and various organizations try to look and identify health. And what we're gonna put some numbers up on the board here, just for fun. This is not, I mean, nobody has to write any of these things down, but just to kind of give a gestalt. I picked five countries that I thought would be of interest to us. United States, Canada, France, China, and Afghanistan. I picked Afghanistan because Afghanistan, we're over there fighting for them, or fighting for something. And they are one of the poorest countries in the world. So, gross domestic product, we all know what that is. That's the total amount of goods and services that a country produces or consumes, divided by the population. And the United States is 39,901. This is what our gross domestic product is divided by the 290 million people or whatever, 300 million people that live in the United States. Canada has a gross domestic product, which is also pretty reasonable. It's 31,389. Obviously, we are individually richer than Canada. France is 30,093. Now, China, the economic miracle that we hear about, these are 2004 figures, and these are figures from the World Health Organization. China is 5,581. 581, yeah. And Afghanistan, $430. That just gives you a huge inequity in this world of ours, isn't it? Well, let's look at life expectancy. We're going to have males and females. So this is not the best way to measure health, but it is a measure of what health is. What do you think life expectancy in 2004 was for a little boy born in the United States?
76.
75 years, very close. And for a girl, it's 80. What can I say? In Canada, it's 78 for men and 83 for women.
Wow.
Anybody here born in Canada? Sorry, pretty poor. In France, it's 76 and 83. And in China, which is a much poorer world, for men it's 70, and for women it's 74. That kind of surprises you, doesn't it? Or at least it surprised me when I first saw that. I somehow thought that China would not have a life expectancy as close. I mean, it's clearly shorter. I mean, it's 5 years shorter, but we've been to China a couple times, and you know, their healthcare system is really atrocious, and most of the people don't get much care at all. And you look at that, and you say, wow. But these figures are probably pretty accurate. And in Afghanistan, it's 42 for men and women. So we see that there is a little bit of a correlation between wealth of a country, but we also see Canada, which has a 25% lower gross domestic product on a per capita basis, has better health statistics.
Not as many Krispy Kreme franchises.
Okay, let's look at something that's very important to us, and that's healthy life expectancy at age 60. That means if you're 60 and you're healthy, so it excludes people that are very ill when they're 60, but if you start off with people who are 60 and seemingly healthy, however we're going to define health, how long can we expect to still be alive and still be healthy? No, so it's not life expectancy, it's healthy life expectancy. And for men, it's 15.1 years. So this is at 60, they can expect, and for women, it's 17.7. And in Canada, it's 16.1, and 19.3 for women. France is almost exactly the same as 16.5 and 20.5. And in China, it's 13.1. and 14.7. And in Afghanistan, it's 10.9 and 11.9. So even if you're in Afghanistan, which is a very poor overall life expectancy because of such high childhood mortality and infant mortality, if you make it to 60 and you're in pretty good shape, you can expect to make it to 70 and still be in pretty good shape. So it isn't that everybody's just dropping off like crazy as they age in the population. But again, the United States is considerably lower than Canada and France in terms of healthy life expectancy. Yes?
I'm Karen from Montana, and so what's happening between age 65 when you're still healthy and 75 when you're probably going to die, and that's where all the money's being spent?
That's exactly right. The biggest amount of money is spent in the last year of people's life. But that's kind of to be expected. That shouldn't come as a surprise. The question is the money being well spent, and are we doing things that are really futile and just prolonging the dying process, or as opposed to helping restore people to an active, functional, satisfying life? Yes.
Cliff, just to kind of introduce the...
Jim from
Yakima. got that part out. To introduce this, the idea of medicine and art into the week's seminar. One of the poets that everyone in the poetry community would agree is... one of the top, most important poets of the 20th century is a physician, William Carlos Williams. And so to add a kind of a negative definition to health, one of his famous lines is, "There's not much news to be had from poetry, yet men and women die miserably every day for lack of what is found there. And then to connect just to China for a second, most American poets are reading those Chinese poets. So I would suggest that there is some form of spirituality in Chinese medicine that does not get included in our typical discussions of medicine.
Good points.
So I didn't mean to take us off that track, but I wanted to just get the art part into the potential to soar.
Well said. Child mortality. This is for your chance that you're going to die before you make the age of 5 years. So this is from birth to 5 years. And we separate by males and females in the United States. For boys, it's 8, and girls, it's 7. This is per 1,000. So in 1,000 births in the United States, 8 of those boys and 7 of those girls will die before the age of 5. That's a little less than 1%. In Canada, it's 6 and 5.
That's better.
In France, it's 5 and 4. In China, it's 27 and 36. And China, now there's two things about China. One is that it's obviously higher. It's also girls have a much higher death rate than boys. And the question is, you know, how many of those are purposeful deaths on the side because of the one-child policies that have been in place and the desire for so many families who only have one child, they want to have a boy. And there is, demographically in China, and this is a potential problem going forward, is that there is an excess of something like 44 million men of the men in the 20 to 30-year-old age group versus the women. So there's a shortage of women in China. And what that means in terms of what's going to happen in the world, nobody knows. Somebody had a question? And in Afghanistan, and this is just awful, 258 and 256.
Mixed race.
So literally 25% of the children in Afghanistan die before they get to be 5 years old.
Wait, was that one in 10,000, did you say, or one in?
Per 1,000.
Per 1,000, thanks.
So that's why it's 25% of 250. Yes?
Sure, answer from Spokane. I know Canada has socialized medicine. Does France have socialized medicine too?
Well, it's a lot of the European countries have kind of a mixture of governmental insurance and private insurance. And France has. I'm not an expert on the French medical system, but they do have universal access, so that everyone is covered in France. And if you've ever traveled, I've had a number of my patients who have traveled to France and gotten ill in France. They're taken care of. I mean, there's no question. If they have insurance in the States, they will bill. They'll try to collect from the States. I don't know how well the U.S. government, U.S. Companies pay, but they have. It's amazing the positive responses that I've had from patients who have been ill in France. France, especially, true in Germany and Spain and other places, but where they have universal coverage, they just take care of people and don't worry about what it's going to cost. They just get very good care. Now we get to who's getting their money's worth here. This is sort of what Consumer Reports would do. I kind of look at this as kind of like Consumer Reports of international health. Per capita expenditures on health. Anybody want to guess what we pay per person in the United States on health? Approximately.
$1,000? Per year?
Per year. $2,000?
$6,000.
How much?
$6,000.
He was here last year. 57.11. This is 2004 data. It's over $6,000 a year right now. But this is in 2004. We pay $5,711 for every man, woman, and child for health care. In Canada, $29.89.
And in and France, it's amazing, it's 2981. I mean, they're almost identical. China spends $278 per person. And Afghanistan spends $26. In other words, most people just don't go to physicians at all. As a percentage of the gross domestic product, 15.2 for the states, 9.9 and 10.1 for France, for Canada and France, 5.6 for China, and 6.5. So Afghanistan is actually spending more per as a per capita than China is, but is so poor that it really doesn't spend very much. But China is only spending, what does that come out to be? About 5% of what we spend on healthcare. And as a and this final figure down there is the per capita government expenditure. What does the government spend? Here in the States, officially it's $25.48, but that does not include the tax benefits of private health insurance that's purchased by corporations, because that's pre-tax dollars. So the government is actually subsidizing that at the corporate, whatever the corporate tax rate is. Although that doesn't count, it counts as a private expenditure. In Canada, it's $20.90. In France, it's $22.15. It's $101 in China, and it's $10 in Afghanistan.
Would you explain that last?
I'm sorry.
Would you explain that last item again?
The last item is the amount of money that's spent by the government per person per year on health care by the government. This would be, in the United States, it would be state, federal, and local government expenditures on health care.
So if you add those two together, then that would be the total?
No, if you, what you would do, you would say that if $2,500 is spent by the government, $3,200 is spent by private, either by private insurance or by out-of-pocket expenditures, or what you pay for your drugs when you go to buy medication.
So the 57.11, that's the total?
That's the total. That's the total that we spend per person on health care.
Well, no. I'm trying to understand it.
Including little kids who aren't having anything done.
including many people that aren't. There are some people that, if somebody has open heart surgery, sure, they're going to have a $50,000 expenditure in 1 year or one person. There were a couple other things that we didn't put up there. Who do you think has the most doctors per 1,000 population? Yes. The ratio of doctors per 1,000. So if you have one doctor for every 1,000 people in the population, the ratio is one. If you have two, it's two. So what would you say?
Not on that list. Cuba.
You're right. It's not on the list. But of these that are on the list. Canada has 2.14 physicians per 1,000. United States has 2.56. So we have more than Canada. However, France has 3.37. So France actually has more physicians per population, yet they spend less of their gross domestic product, and they spend a very higher percentage of the total health expenditures are governmental expenditures. I don't have the data for Cuba. If you do have it, but I suspect that the percentage is probably 90% or more.
I don't know. I just know from everything I've read and my experiences in traveling that it's very high, and they train physicians from other countries, including the United States, for, I think, free or nominal costs.
So what we have there, and it's not, it's just to kind of give you a gestalt as to how much money is spent in different parts of the world on healthcare. And the correlation isn't all that great. The correlation is more on the gross domestic product with some of the health issues than it is on what you spend, because you can see the United States has the, we spend so much more in healthcare, and we don't have a whole lot more to show for it.
I'm Carol from Minnesota. I have a question. If in Afghanistan you started this life expectancy after age 5, in other words, this 258 or 256, then I would assume that that 42 would be much higher. So if
absolutely.
You live past 5, if you live to you're 10 years old, then your chances of living to...
Absolutely. And that's why I put in that healthy life expectancy at age 60 to point out that that if you make it to 60, if you make it to 5, if you make it to 10, you're going to do a whole lot... The differences aren't going to be that great.
Yeah, so the 42 is rather skewed.
Where the real differences occur and where the real impact occurs in terms of health care is neonatal care. That really, we really do have a significant impact there. And we have a pretty big impact at end-of-life kinds of things. But what in terms of what medicine can do, now the question is, I think most of us would agree that, you know, helping prenatal care and perinatal care makes a lot of sense. Does it make a lot of sense for us to be going into the public funds and pool resources and providing end-of-life care for somebody who's 95 years old and keeping that person alive for another 6 months with chemotherapy for cancer at a cost of $200,000? We may prolong that person's life, and that person may be very happy for that. And they might not be happy, but let's just assume they can be happy. Let's just say the side effects are minimal and you can really help somebody. Should we be doing that? Does there come a point in one's life, and we'll kind of discuss this a little bit more, is this really an appropriate use when we know that if we spend $100,000 on this 95-year-old, and I pick a 105-year-old, and then everybody really will agree, you know, as we get closer and closer to their own age, it becomes, well, you know, you know, I'm not so sure. But if we say 100, you know, most of us could agree that we're not going to have any major intervention for people over 105, 110. I pick a number. I think we could probably come to that. Maybe we can't. Maybe some people say every life is equally valuable. But when we spend that money, we are not going to have money to educate our kids. We're not going to have, because we really do have this challenge of limited resources. And to pretend that we have this huge pool of money that we can provide unlimited care, unlimited access for one group of the population, and not provide some other basic things that may have a greater impact on overall health, such as education. Yes, question.
And even within the neonatal sector, there are ethical questions on spending $1 million on a 1,000-gram baby,
exactly,
whose life expectancy may be up into the normal range, but whose quality of life may be hugely impacted, and also that $1 million then isn't spent on something immunizations.
Excellent point. I have a sister who's a neonatal intensive care unit nurse. You know, she earns her living doing this, and as she's gotten older and has seen they have these reunions where they bring some of these kids back. And only the good ones come back, because somebody has a really bad child, doesn't want to come back, number one, doesn't come back to the reunions. But even the good ones frequently are not very good. You know, these kids have cerebral palsy, and they're blind, and they have learning disabilities, and it's after huge, huge expenditures. Rick Firstthing.
Rick from Minnesota. At what point in the conversation, Cliff, do you start to deal with the language of health care or sickness care? What do you find the authors that try to make that distinction? Do you make that helpful?
No, I don't. I there's health promotion and sickness care. Most of medical education and medicine is disease oriented, and that's because it has proved, Western medicine has proved so successful in dealing with acute diseases, and it's so successful that we've essentially eliminated acute diseases as a cause of death. I mean, not obviously not completely, but what people used to die from, They died from, and younger people, they, you know, they died from pneumonia, they died from serious infections, and now they die of degenerative diseases and cancer late in life. Much more predictable kinds of diseases, but where Western medicine doesn't do anywhere near as, is not anywhere near as successful. Yes?
Carol, from the LA area, and let's see, I think, I'm not sure where I actually stand on the issue, but I think what you just brought up raises a lot of ethical questions that is really, I think, difficult, and I don't know who has the answer for this, but in terms of like neonatal care or care for anybody at any point who has some illness, who is to say that somebody who has an illness or a condition cannot be a very contributing member to society and have something that, that, you know, they may contribute something astounding even though they have certain physical limitations. So I think it's in this area, if we just talk about social contributions and the right to live, that it's
gray.
Yeah.
No, absolutely. You're absolutely right.
Neil from East Wenatchee, it's 9:15.
Can I just, there was a question in the back of the room, the man sitting way at the back, and I just want to let him have a chance.
I just wondered what effect malpractice laws had on the cost per person in various countries.
It's estimated that malpractice contributes somewhere between 3 and 5% additional cost to the United States over most other countries. We by far have the biggest problem with malpractice. Most of that is not the malpractice rates themselves, although in some, certain specialties in certain geographic areas they are really exorbitant. But there's a type of defensive medicine that's practiced that you've heard about, and that really is pervasive throughout the, and so it may be considerably more than that 3 to 5% because of what defensive medicine becomes a standard of care. And so we do things that initially were started because of a fear of malpractice, and then it just becomes, well, that's just the way we do things. Nobody doesn't think specifically, well, I'm doing this because I don't want to get sued. You're just doing it because you want to be complete and thorough where you really didn't have to be. And it's, if any of you goes into an emergency room with a headache, I can guarantee you you're going to get an MR scan or a CT scan. That was not the case 10 years ago. But the pressure now is on because for that one in 10,000 times that you miss the case, you get a, you know, a $5 million lawsuit slapped on you. So, and that costs society a lot of money. Good point. Excellent point. Time. Five minutes.
I think it's 15, Cliff. I don't think it's just 5. 5 is not long enough for people to get to the bathroom and back. So make it 15.
If I say 15, it'll be 20.
No,
if I say
no. 10. Yeah, 10. And does everybody know where the bathrooms are? The closest bathrooms
up here.
Outside.
Upstate. Well, up there, up here.
Why don't you tell them about 2 other ones? Because not everybody's going to make that bathroom.
Where's the
in
other
10
2?
Minutes. You don't know?
No.
Okay, there's one in that building right over there where we had Vespers last night.
Yeah.
If you go through that closest door and just go straight back, there's a bathroom there, and there's also a bathroom near the registration desk in the hotel. So there are 3,
and on the basement.
And the basement.
Across the way too. So there are different bathrooms. So don't all go to the same one. Carol, do you have a name?
Carol 3.
Yeah, I forgot. All right. I thought maybe.
Yes. No, I have one.
Thank you.
Do you have
any more hands on
the No, I don't. But I'm sure it's more zero. right. Thank you.
Otherwise, here,
Needle point. Yeah, I was there.
Yeah, I mean,
yeah.
Yeah.
That's the listing of the books, isn't it?
I think we will, but probably. Yeah, they do. I can get you a copy of that. I will make a point of doing that.
I did get that one on Equity. Equity did come through.
No, this thing, I did not hand this out. This is going to be handed out.
That
healthcare equity was not supposed to be handed out yet. But yeah. That's okay. It's going to go out.
We're going to talk about the Oregon. The beautiful thing they do. They call it the Switzerland of America. I don't know if I quite belong to that, but it is very, very pretty. We stayed at a hotel there and we worked each day. And we had a meal. So that was very, very exciting. And they were all basically hackers. We had one lady that had trouble hooking up with
But we've had our 10 minutes.
That's true.
So what I would like to do is just make a few more comments about some of these numbers and about life expectancy, and then talk about a little more about the United States healthcare system. When we look at overall life expectancy numbers. There was a study that just came out, and we were listening to a discussion of it on NPR as we drove up here on Friday, as we drove to Lake Chelan on Friday. What we're really dealing with is we don't have just one population in the United States. We have a whole series of populations, and a group just recently has looked at this, a group headed by Christopher Murray, and he really divided the United States into eight groups. Eight separate groups, and he looked at and one group is Asian Americans with an average per capita income. Then that's not GDP divided by per capita. This is what the average per capita income. These Asian Americans, the average income of $21,000 a year, have an average life expectancy. This is men and women together of 84.9 years. That's the Asian Americans. On the other end of the extreme are urban blacks. With an income of $14,800 with a life expectancy of 71 years. And if you look at some specifics, such as urban blacks in in District of Columbia, when you break this down by county, then you look at blacks in D.C. Life expectancy in the United States, urban blacks, 57.9 years.
Wow.
Urban black male. So we have within this country a tremendous disparity by group. And there's a lot of work and a lot of study and a lot of exposition has gone into trying to define why is that? Well, you know, because what you have is the life expectancy of urban black males in District of Columbia is about the same as males in Bangladesh. And then you say, it's poverty. I mean, you go to Bangladesh and poverty is so throughout the country. You have people living on $1 or $2 a day. And yet the urban black males in the United States are living on $15,000 a year. So it isn't absolute poverty levels. And the more people have looked at this, there is a real problem with gradients, a long gradient of social economic change, taking people from the highest to the lowest economic levels. And it turns out, it isn't just an absolute level of poverty, it's how poor you are relative to your neighbors and the people you see and the people you come in contact with, which is an extraordinary, and if everybody is poor in a community, then within that community tends to do better health-wise than if there are some poor people and there are some rich people in the community. And the greater the disparity of incomes and education, the greater the disparity in health outcomes.
Do you have any sense of why that is?
Well, there's a lot of theories, but one of the theories is just the stress. That this is a lifelong stress reaction of not being in control. People who have resources, like most of us do, feel reasonably in control. Now, we might forget our wallet or our checkbook and feel out of control, but and you know how bad that felt. Can you imagine feeling that way all the time?
Yeah, right now.
Just that things are just out of control. You just don't have the money. You just, you know, what am I going to do? How am I going to do this? We just don't know. The book Nickel and Dime, I think many of you probably have read, know how what it's like to try to get along in a society, not where everybody is poor, but where you're poor relative to everybody else. And every day you see the wealth and the people able to do the kind of things they want to do, and then where you don't feel that. And so that may have a big impact. The other thing that has a big impact are personal behaviors. And there's no question that there's a gradient. You don't see smoking in boardrooms anymore. But you do see the blue-collar workers who still smoke. You don't see physicians smoking, and you see nurses smoking. Not as much now, but there still is that there is a variant on the socioeconomic curve. There is also huge differences from country to country. I have some data here on the European Union, which looks at a number of things that can affect health, such as the number of cigarettes smoked per day per adult. The United States is an average of 4.9 cigarettes per adult per day. 4.9. In the lowest, Norway, 1.7. So the Norwegians don't smoke very much. The highest, Greece, 8.3. How about alcohol? The amount of alcohol you drink in liters per year. The United States, an average of 4.7. In the entire European Union, it's 11.1. It goes up. In France, it's 14.1. Like three times the amount of alcohol they drink in France. If you look at suicide rates per 100,000 people, the United States it's 13. 13 per 100,000 people per year commit suicide. Finland,
U.S.
In U.S. In Finland, it's 26, double the rate. The lowest rate is in Greece. Lowest rate for suicide, 3.1. Now they have the highest rate for smoking. Whatever that is, this is an interesting statistic, how it relates to health or not, I'm not sure, but it's the number of births out of wedlock. Anybody want to give a guess as to how many children are born in the United States out of wedlock as a percentage of all the births? Ballpark, 5%, 20%, 30%, 50%.
30.
30. 30. 20. I hear numbers all over the place. In the United States, it's 32%. 32%. If you go to Iceland, which is the highest, 65%. So 65% in Iceland, 49% in Norway, 54% in Sweden. Denmark is 46%. The Northern European countries, it's almost, it's essentially 50% of all children are born out of wedlock.
Oh, but doesn't abortion come involved in that too? How many are aborted?
I don't have that.
And
I don't have that figure.
And how many of those are teen births versus adults?
Oh, but they're later in life. Yeah, that's right. We have a much higher teen pregnancy rate in the United States. Greece has the lowest. Only 3% of children born in Greece are born out of wedlock. Whatever that means. And I don't know how that relates to health, but if you look, they smoke more in Greece. They have a very low suicide rate, and they have one of the longest life expectancies. It's the olive oil, and certainly the suicides clearly correlate with Northern European. They're committing suicide and they're having children out of wedlock. I don't know how those go together.
Dark
night,
the darkness.
Yes.
That's the dark night.
I think it's the weather. It's cold and dark.
It's cold and dark.
It's depressing and they get together.
That's probably right. Any questions about looking at health from kind of a global point of view before we've kind of focused in a little bit on what we do in the United States?
Karen, did you have something?
No, it was answered.
Thanks. Okay.
Globally, I think we should, our country should be ashamed of our healthcare system compared to other countries that on less money, they do better.
No question about that. But maybe it's not the healthcare system. That's the problem. Well, I think that's what we ought to figure out, because we pour a lot of money into the healthcare system and our statistics don't show that we're a particularly healthy society. And so the question is it a failure of the healthcare system, a failure of access to the healthcare system, which I'm sure is part of it. Mm-hmm. But is that the major determinant of health? So in other words, do doctors and nurses and hospitals and nursing homes and emergency rooms are they really the major determinant of the quality of health? Or are there other factors that are much more important in determining whether you're healthy or not? And that was coming out a little bit on this when we mentioned that within these groups, I mean, clearly people, even the poor people who have Medicaid, Medi-Cal, have pretty good health coverage. They certainly have access to emergency rooms, and they certainly aren't going to, you know, if they get run over by a truck, they're going to be well taken care of. That would not be the case in Bangladesh. And yet they have a mortality rate that's similar to what you'd have in Bangladesh. So you have to say, well, what is it about living in their society that causes their illness, their level of health to be so low? Yeah.
I'm Shirley from Portland. I feel that has a lot to do with the when you're growing up and you are taught that you deserve or you should get health care, that's not something that I can do or something that I can afford. Or choose, you know, they would choose not to do it, and not even, you know, look into the possibility of getting care. Going with the attitude that, well, I don't, I'm poor, and I'm not going to be able to do that. I know I have a neighbor that's a black lady, and I mean, there's just no chance. She's just. Feels there's no chance that she can get care because she's low income and she's black and has that attitude.
Well, that certainly is a major problem. I don't want to in any way imply that that isn't a major role, but it doesn't play a major role. And that is something that we can address and I think should be addressing in terms of what do we do about the healthcare system and how do we fix it. At the same time, we need to look at what other things that we're doing in this society that is not health promoting.
Cliff, I'm Kay from Wenatchee. I often wonder when we hear our president and other people say we have the highest standard of living in America, and it's kind of we brag about it. But I wonder what is the criteria, because when I think of the problems that we face and the number of people we have behind bars and so forth compared to other countries also. Is that all ever taken into consideration? I don't know if we have the highest standard of living compared to some of these other countries.
We have more billionaires than any other country.
That skews
that number, that the GDP per capita gets skewed. And we have some of the greatest discrepancy between the very rich and the very poor, and I think that is what may come out in some of our discussions. I have another handout, which is a discussion by Stephen Baruska, which we'll hand out at the end of the session, in which he really addresses that. I think that's a major issue, and things seem to be getting worse. I mean, the tax cuts are going to the rich, and at the same time, the number of poor are not getting better. And we have statistics that we should be embarrassed about. I agree with you. We should be embarrassed.
Yeah, and what do you call high standard of living? What qualifies for that?
I'm interested in being up here at Holda Catherine from Portland, because I think a lot of food, the misuse of food. I mean, we know it's lifestyle choices that play into our poor state of health. But food certainly is a sporific, and I think that people are lonely and they hunger for community, and we have erred certainly in the last 3 or 4 decades in being there fully for one another. And so I know that a lot of people eat out that frustration. Women in particular, we're relational. It's the whole idea of tending, befriend, and we're not there for one another. And so I think guilt is a very poor motivational tool. We should be thin and healthy now if we took seriously all the articles and information on what we need to be doing, and we're not paying attention. So again, how to restructure community so we're able to meet the deeper emotional needs of people that otherwise play themselves out in addictive behaviors, food, drink, alcohol, nicotine, that kind of thing.
Good point.
Do you know any of those happiness factors? You know, that you see studies of which countries consider themselves happy people or within countries that I don't know what the determinants are, or how they study that, or how they measure it. But you know how the U.S. compares with other countries.
I don't know. I have seen. In the past year, there's been some publications out, and I recall seeing them, and I know there's essentially no there's a correlation with income at the very low ranges. Mm-hmm. If you're very very poor, you're much more depressed and much less happy, and up until a point where there's an inflection point. Where your basic needs are met, your basic for food, shelter, transportation, some very basic things are met, and then after that, there is essentially no correlation whatsoever. Once you get up, your income, whether it's $50,000 or $150,000 or $500,000 a year, doesn't correlate whatsoever with. So I've seen it on that basis.
Yeah.
As far as from transcultural and different countries, I really don't know about that.
Maybe play into that.
I'm sure it does.
Stress of
and
not
I'm sure it plays.
I'm
sure that's exactly
that
right.
People that doesn't, if you're comparing yourself to your neighbor,
you see what they have and you don't.
And you don't. Yeah. That's a source of unhappiness, maybe a source of stress. You say that people who are surrounded by wealthier people than them have a lower health issue.
Back to the food thing. For years we've been bombarded with ads for the kind of food we should buy and eat. And I think it's starting to turn around. The schools are now having healthy food, and they're getting rid of the soft drinks and things that aren't good for us. So I think it is starting to turn around, but there are still people that still go by what they're told to eat, by the ads,
sure,
by TV.
Yeah.
Neil from Wenatchee. I'm just wondering, you know, we talked about the neighbor, you know, you see the stress, I mean, this person's well, and you're poor. But how much does the poor, you know, see this on television? How much does that impress them and the stress? Because television brings everything and all the wealth and everything else there. And I want to kind of think that in where I worked in the United States in poor areas, the first thing they buy is a television set. And so to me, that brings in the stress.
Sure, sure. And it does it on a global yeah. scale, too. I mean, everybody mm-hmm. sees everything now.
Yeah.
Well, we do have a healthcare system. Some people would call it a non-system. And for those of us who have access to good insurance and to primary care physician and a referral to specialists, we really do have as good a medical care system as you could really ask for. In fact, we maybe the problem comes not for those of us who have good access in terms of not getting enough, but perhaps getting too much. And not knowing when to when enough is enough, but there are some changes that started to occur back in the 1980s and really accelerated in the 1990s that really put huge pressures on the system. The inflation rate was essentially double digit for a decade in terms of healthcare costs in the United States. There's a huge demographic challenge faced by the baby boom generation that's coming along. I'm sure you all know that the majority of health care dollars are consumed by the elderly. And that's not a surprise because we accumulate all the chronic diseases and infirmities that need medical attention. Technology has been absolutely unbelievable in my generation of as a physician to think back the way I was practicing medicine in the late 60s and early 70s compared to what we have available to us now. I mean, I don't know why everybody didn't die. Any of our patients survived. We didn't have a clue of what we were doing, and we didn't have any of the technology to support us. And a lot of what we were doing was wrong. I mean, it was clearly wrong, and I'm sure a lot of what we're doing now is going to be looked back by the next generation as being wrong as well. And so that's always humbling. Expectations of the population, maybe in part from television, all those doctor programs and, you know, about how daily miracles that you see on television. So expectations extraordinarily high. The malpractice issue has been talked about. Administrative costs in the United States are just unbelievable. You just go into hospitals and it's almost more administrators than there are people actually taking care of patients. And we use too much high tech late in life, feudal care. Then superimpose that on the drug problems we have in the United States, the violence, the guns that are available. So we have this huge huge problem. It was addressed in the early 90s by the Clinton administration in a way that was theoretically good but practically wrong, and it ended up not going anywhere, and it became the third rail. And even now, the American politicians do not want to talk about health care. That just is something they just don't want to touch, even though we know that in 15 years, Medicare will be bankrupt. So those of you who are still expecting, those of you that have 15 years of quality life ahead, that's you enjoy them because the system is going to be bankrupt. Unless we get another infusion of money or we learn how to control the costs. And it is not obvious that we have either lined up and that we are just going to keep mortgaging our children to keep paying for our health care. Yes?
Rick from Minnesota, just the week before we came here, they're starting to have debates between our top state governmental candidates, and they are recognizing vocally that this is the number one problem the state faces. Health care. However, they get 90 seconds to solve the problem. And so that they all, what they do is they recognize a problem, although none of them are given a serious hearing about a solution.
Actually, the state governments are very much, very acutely aware. Oregon last year, for the first time, spent more money on health care as a state government than they did on primary education, primary and secondary, all education. That is happening, and we're not the first state in the union where that has happened. And so that's happening right everywhere. And so we've reached a terrible point in our government. Yes?
Do they have a state?